Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Thursday, April 9th. President Trump is already angling to suppress the vote for when he and presumably Joe Biden face off in November. The president claims widespread voting by mail is a risk for voter fraud, and he seemed to admit his real motivation when he tweeted yesterday that mail-in voting, quote, for whatever reason, doesn't work out well for Republicans. And the Times today has a detailed article about the lack of fraud in states that already use mail-in ballots. I'll read a little bit of that New York Times article in this segment. With me now on that and more is USA Today Washington Bureau Chief Susan Page. Thanks so much for continuing to come on with us under all this pressure. Welcome back to WNYC, Susan.
Brian, it's my honor to be here with you.
Why did this come up? The president and his last few daily briefings and on Twitter there attacking mail-in voting.
Well, the Republicans are focused on what's going to happen in November when the president will be up for a second term. And of course, this is going to be a different kind of election day. Given what will be a continued situation with the coronavirus, however, whatever course it takes over the next few months. Democrats are very interested in expanding the ways people can vote, especially mail-in ballots, which is something that's worked with some success in states and is a way that eliminates the health challenges of having an election at a time of pandemic. And Republicans are aggressively opposing efforts in states across the country to do that.
Another piece of evidence of what this is really about, in addition to Trump kind of revealing his hand by tweeting, for whatever reason, this doesn't work out well for Republicans. Another piece of evidence comes from Georgia. The Times reports that in Georgia, where the Secretary of State is mailing all voters absentee ballot requests for the May primary, so they're actually doing it, the State House Speaker, David Ralston, a Republican, told the local news site, "This will be extremely devastating to Republicans and conservatives in Georgia. This will drive up turnout." That's a remarkable quote to me because he's admitting he's against turnout. And he seems to admit that the more fully Americans vote, the more fully those votes get counted, the worse it happens to be for his party. Now, in normal times, that would be a huge admission of motivation and intention to suppress the vote. Politically, I don't know what it is in these times.
Well, there's a lot of news to deal with. But, you know, the president himself made a similar comment a couple of weeks ago. He said that if they followed plans by Democrats to expand early voting, which is another way to try to deal with the pandemic, and voting by mail, he said, quote, "You'd never have a Republican elected in this country again." And you saw this in action this week with that bizarre primary in Wisconsin, the bizarre election in Wisconsin, which went ahead despite efforts by the Democratic governor to postpone it or to take other steps. And that was all about reducing turnout in places like Milwaukee, where there are a lot of Democratic voters, in order to have an effect on a key election there for the state Supreme Court. We don't know how the Wisconsin vote has turned out yet because of delays in the count with absentee votes. But there is definitely a concerted political effort on the part of the GOP to try to manage efforts to expand turnout in new and different ways in November.
Do they have any argument to make that somehow mail-in voting and early voting bias a vote against Republicans? In other words, in a way that would create an inaccurate vote of the people, as opposed to simply expanding turnout, and therefore more Americans are participating. And if what that shows is that most of the Americans who weren't participating were for Democrats, then that's where the chips fall.
So the president said that it's open to fraud and that you'd have people in rooms signing mail ballot after mail ballot. There's no credible study that shows a problem with fraud with mail voting. Mail voting can be quite secure. It is reminiscent of the arguments that the president has made since the 2016 election, where he has said that there was massive voter fraud, voting by undocumented residents of the United States who weren't eligible to vote. The credible studies of that show that that didn't happen either. But those are the assertions that he has made in both these cases.
The New York Times article I've been citing from is headlined, "Trump is pushing a false argument on vote-by-mail fraud. Here are the facts." And I'm just going to read one fact and description of that fact from that article. It says, states that vote entirely by mail see little fraud. Five states, including the Republican bastion of Utah, now conduct all elections almost entirely by mail. They report very little fraud. The state is among the six states with the highest percentage of mail-in votes in the last election in 2018, that's Utah, all of which had Republican state election supervisors at the time, those six states, according to David Becker, the director of the Center for Election Innovation and Reform. In other words, six states with Republican state election supervisors that use mail-in ballots in a widespread way, they all report little to no voter fraud. So just saying. Do you know if what's left of the Voting Rights Act would have anything to say about this as a reason for fighting against mail-in voting under these social distancing circumstances? In other words, that it would be some kind of illegal voter suppression attempt, especially as they admit their motivations, like in the case of Trump and that Republican House Speaker in Georgia?
You know, you could certainly turn to the courts to appeal what Republican legislatures are doing. That has not worked very well in the recent past. We had just this week the top court in Wisconsin and the U.S. Supreme Court decline to view the coronavirus pandemic as a reason to agree to changes in voting, to agree to extending mail-in balloting, for instance. And those, unfortunately, I'm sad to say, those decisions were both issued along party lines. So I'm sure that people can turn to the courts. At the moment, it's not clear whether they'd get relief by doing that.
Before we leave early voting, we should say that, or mail-in voting, we should say, I think it's not actually up to Trump or the federal government because each state makes its voting laws. So do you think that that makes whatever Trump says, whatever debate he has now started, moot?
No, I don't think it makes it moot. It is true that voting is a state enterprise, but we know that President Trump has enormously high standing in the Republican Party, and that we have seen Republican officials really follow his lead on any number of things. So I think when the president says that this is open to fraud, you should oppose it. I think that is a message that any number of Republican governors and state legislators are going to hear.
I see on USA Today that despite the president's primetime nightly show, his approval ratings in general and on handling the virus, which were high, just took a dip. Have you seen the details?
So we had six different national polls come out yesterday. And in all six of them, President Trump's approval rating was below 50%. It was exactly where it's been since the beginning of his administration. His approval rating, his overall job approval rating, between 40 and 45% in all six of these polls. This reflects, it's been interesting as you watch the president's approval rating since the pandemic became a big issue. It bumped up a few points early on, which is what you would expect. Traditionally, country faces a crisis, the nation rallies around the president, his approval rating goes up, often goes up a lot more than the few points it did with Trump. That now has subsided. And he's back right in the range where he's been from the start. President Trump's approval rating has been so remarkably steady. It's like a heartbeat that never gets much faster or much slower. There's something else that we've found that's interesting, I think, when you look at surveys, both nationwide surveys and statewide surveys. You see the approval rating for other officials dealing with the coronavirus spike up much higher in the Quinnipiac poll that came out yesterday. Anthony Fauci has a 78% approval rating.
Fauci for president.
Your governor, not Andrew Cuomo, just the generic, your governor, 74% approval rating. That's very high. Andrew Cuomo in particular, 59% approval rating. That's double digits higher than the approval rating Trump had in this poll for handling the coronavirus at 46%. And in fact, Congress, everybody hates Congress, right? Congress had an approval rating of 44%, which is like golden territory for, you know, a governmental institution that's undergone so much, you know, negative press and bad feeling in recent years.
Do you think you have an instant analysis of why Trump's approval ratings on handling coronavirus in particular have declined from that 60% peak that he hit last month down to the 40s that you're describing today? Because his strategy seems to be to take this primetime real estate on television every night and to be what he calls a cheerleader for America, to present the good news, to present the things that his government is doing to fight coronavirus and rally the country around him that way, as well as, you know, lob rhetorical bombs at his enemies. He'll pick another one each day. This is what he does at his rallies that have worked for him. These have become like Trump rallies of the air. They're obviously using them that way, and they think they're hitting the right notes. What's going wrong?
Well, they're hitting the right notes for preserving his base, which has always been President Trump's primary goal politically as president, is to reinforce his base at all costs. He's almost never done things that try to expand his base. And I think we see that instinct when it comes to these remarkable, unprecedented daily briefings at the White House that go on for 2 hours, in which the president starts by reading a prepared statement about all the things the federal government is doing. Then he has skeptical questions from reporters who point out reports from places like New York City, where things are incredibly dire, and often then goes off on tangents attacking politicians, it is like his rallies. So people who support him think it's great, and people who are not inclined to support him, I think, look at that and have questions about whether that's the approach they want to see their president to take during a time of crisis.
Lawrence in Anchorage, Alaska. You're on with us, Lawrence. Thanks so much for calling in.
Hello. It's an honor to speak with you. I used to live in New Jersey and listen to your show many years ago when I was there, and now I'm here in Anchorage. You know, Alaska is a Republican state. We've had mail-in ballots here forever, and it's all about majority. You know, the majority of the voters are Democrat. They're going to vote, and if it's easier for them to do it, which it is, I feel, by mail-in, then that's going to happen. But, you know, we have a majority Republican state, obviously, and so it's bogus to say that Republicans are going to be hurt by mail-in ballots. It's obviously not true here in Anchorage. By the way, we just had ballots going in yesterday or the Tuesday, and only 32% of the people in Anchorage voted, even with mail-in ballots. So, you know, it doesn't always lead to good numbers.
Lawrence, thank you very much for chiming in. Call us again from up there. Gail in Queens, you're on WNYC with Susan Page from USA Today. Hi, Gail.
Good morning. The Trump administration, according to WNYC, about 10 days ago, eliminated a federal agency for emergency preparedness, and the pandemic would have fallen into this agent. Preparedness for the pandemic would have fallen into this agency. And apparently this agency existed through the Obama administration. I am absolutely aghast that people are not jumping up and down and screaming about this. Why are we not hearing more about this?
Susan, you want to talk more about this?
Gail, thanks so much for your call. You know, I think there have been some serious efforts to look at how we got to where we are now, including looking at actions by the Obama administration and by the Trump administration. One of the things that has gotten a fair amount of attention is the Trump administration's decision to eliminate the office in the National Security Council that was designed to look out for and prepare for the threat of pandemics. I think we're going to hear more about that, but at the moment, people are, I think, focused, first of all, with the crisis at hand. So that's why you see more discussion about how can we get more tests? How can we get more ventilators? What's the situation in emergency rooms in New York and across the country? There will come a time, I think, when there is a serious examination of everything that led up to this. And in fact, one of the debates and one of the conflicts you see now going on in Washington is setting up the agencies that will conduct that kind of review. For instance, the inspectors general who will be looking at expenditures under these under this massive federal spending program that has just been launched. So oversight is going to be part of it. But I think there are a lot of people who look at the moment and worry about the crisis at hand first.
There does also seem to be blame to go around. I don't know what your biggest picture view on this is. You're much closer to it than I am, being a Washington bureau chief. But Trump at these news conferences tries to spread blame elsewhere when questions like Gail's come up. This week he's been going after the World Health Organization for blowing the early response, allegedly. He's singled out the Centers for Disease Control and the Food and Drug Administration and Cuomo with his high poll numbers for things that New York State didn't do earlier on. And some of this is true. From what I've read, you know, the testing debacle in this country was not of Trump's making alone, certainly. It was a CDC debacle. It was an FDA debacle. And so he's got some targets to shoot at that aren't completely phony. I don't know how we look at the big picture yet.
You know, I think there is, I don't think President Trump caused the virus or is solely responsible for the faltering response that we've seen the federal government take toward the crisis. There's criticism, for instance, of the Obama administration for not having restocked the national stockpile after it was much of it was used up in response to previous pandemics. Now, Democrats say Republicans were unwilling to allocate more money for the stockpile. There'll be a debate about that. But it's true. It's not all President Trump's fault. And this question with the World Health Organization is perplexing me. I'm not sure if I understand whether the criticism the president leveled yesterday is legitimate, or his apparent decision to withhold U.S. funding. You know, the United States is the biggest funder for the WHO. President Trump, at his briefing, first said we were putting a powerful hold on that funding. And then when a reporter asked about it, he said, I never said that. We're just taking a look at it. So I don't know exactly what the situation is with that. But in that case, President Trump says that it was too China-centric, that it was paying too much attention to China, mm-hmm. accepting what China was saying, slow to sound alarms about the pending threat. That is another thing that'll be worth taking a look at. But I think it is fair to say that President Trump is responsible for what the federal government has and hasn't done, for the slow and reluctant use of his powers to order the production of material, and his refusal to seize control of the medical supply chain in a way that would allow, to keep states, for instance, from bidding against each other on the open market for things like ventilators and masks.
Meanwhile, Susan, the Centers for Disease Control has new guidelines easing up a little bit on who must remain out of work and which essential workers can go back. Are you familiar with what they're changing?
Well, we heard about this at the White House briefing yesterday from the director of the CDC, who said that essential workers who had been exposed to the virus could go back to work if they don't have symptoms. It called for them to take some precautions, like wearing a mask at all times and taking their temperature and going home if they feel sick. But this does loosen the guidelines in a way that has alarmed some other public health officials who keep pointing out that you don't have to have symptoms to be spreading the virus.
We're getting a call from France. So let's talk to Douglas in France. Hi, Douglas. Hello from New York and the United States.
Brian, thank you very much. And again, thank you very much. You're one of my lifelines here in France.
Thank you.
I wanted to offer my opinion about what I think is going on in the United States, because I believe that there is an extreme sinister component to what's going on. I do not think that this is incompetence from the administration whatsoever. We're seeing it here in a really different way, and I see it in a different way personally. And I believe that this is very intentional. We're looking at the absolute refusal of the administration to pass around supplies and equipment and personnel, et cetera. And there's no, we have an expression here in France, il n'y a pas 36 solutions. There's not 36 answers. There's just one answer. So I think that what I'm missing from the media is an answer as to why there's a fundamental refusal of services and equipment. There has to be an answer. And I believe that this is the Trump's base. I have relatives in Texas. So I believe Trump's base, I'm sure, wants to eliminate minorities at any level that they possibly can. This is at the heart of their refusal of public education. This is at the heart of their refusal of public health care. And now this is at the heart of the administration's refusal of actual ventilators and masks, et cetera.
Douglas, before I get a Susan Page response on that political analysis, what's the other side of the equation that you're referring to? In other words, what is Macron doing over there?
Well, Macron is actually being a leader. I'm not necessarily a Macron fan at every level. But he's doing the right thing. He's getting everyone to stay in. He's absolutely requiring that we isolate. He yelled at the French people dramatically, and he's doing the presidential thing.
What did he yell? Like, stay home, stay home, stay home?
He goes, "What are you doing? I told you to stay home. You know. So now you didn't stay home." He's basically talking about Paris and some of the larger cities. This was several weeks ago. And then he came down and he mandated that we were, in fact, going to stay in, you know.
Douglas, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you so much for chiming in. Do call us again. And Susan, I'm sure when he says Trump is out to eliminate minorities, just so people don't misunderstand and get response without following up, I'm sure he's not recommending mass murder, that suggesting that Trump wants to see mass death among people of color. But what about the context of what he is saying in terms of intentionality here?
So, you know, this has been a persistent question. Why has President Trump not taken more decisive action to respond to this threat and deal with it in a more coherent way? And the two explanations that make the most sense to me is, one, he has been reluctant to take action that might make him responsible for what happens. So he has been eager to take some steps, but not really seize control in the hopes that presumably that the governors will bear the blame when things go wrong, or the news media, or the WHO. He, in fact, said at one point, I'm not responsible for any of this. I think that's part of it. I think the other part, I think we should not underestimate the power of incompetence. The fact that some key agencies and some key positions were not filled, that there has not been a coherent policy process on this and on other things in the Trump administration, that President Trump very much trusts his gut and can be impulsive and can change course in ways that leave even officials, that can leave other officials confused about what it is they're supposed to do. And that I think those two things are the ones that make the most sense to me when you look at why hasn't he done some of the things that seem like such important steps to try to save lives.
USA Today, Washington Bureau Chief, Susan Page, as always, thank you so much.
Hey, thank you, Brian. Stay safe.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is obviously also a Daily Coronavirus podcast under the circumstances in our country right now. We'll keep staying on top of things to serve you the best we can. And remember, this podcast is excerpted from my live weekday call-in show, The Brian Lehrer Show. If you want to be a caller or just hear it live, it's from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time on WNYC Radio in New York, or online at WNYC.org. You can also tweet a question at us anytime. Just tweet at Brian Lehrer. Thanks for listening today.